All right, let's look at biblical objectivity. We're going to try to get through this and then actually get down to the nuts and bolts of news writing, some of the elements and all that. And we can catch up this afternoon. I built some time into this where I was going to make you do some work and try to humiliate some of you a little bit. We don't have an overhead. I used to put them on the overhead and you put your leads on the overhead, but we'll do that, but try to keep the humiliation to a stress to a lower level. But I want to talk about true objectivity, as I spoke of a minute ago. This is, again, what you're getting is essentially the World Journalism Institute's take on journalism, their approach to journalism, which I think is right. And here are the six rapids of difficulty, as Marvin Alasky defines them, in terms of biblically focused reporting. First, class one is these are the class one rapids. And what we want to avoid, we want to push the Christian worldview hard, push Scripture hard, but not twist Scripture, because we've seen there's kinds of journalism, they're either legalism or they twist Scripture. We want to avoid that at all costs. But class one, explicit biblical embrace or condemnation. When there's an explicit biblical embrace of an ethical practice or a theological doctrine or a condemnation of it, then we're free to do that. Homosexuality, I think, a clear example here because the Bible strictly forbids it. Biblical objectivity means showing the evil of homosexuality. We're being biblically objective. We don't say objectivity for the Christian is not saying, well, here's one argument against homosexuality, here's one argument for it, because that's what I was taught in journalism school at the University of Georgia. And maybe that's why the football team's struggling these days, I don't know. But anyway, I was taught, well, you get both quotes from someone but you usually set up the evangelical as kind of a knucklehead. Here's the knucklehead, and then here's the really reasonable man. We're going to get to how they set that up later and why, how you can get bias into a story without obviously being biased, and how my colleagues always did it, and I honestly tried to counterbalance that a bit. But so biblical objectivity means showing the evil of homosexuality because Scripture calls it evil. So we don't apologize when we say that homosexuality is evil or abortion or all that. I mean, giving equal time to gay activists or to pro-abortion activists is ungodly journalism. Bottom line, ungodly journalism. Class two rapids or class two issues. These are issues in which there's clearly an implicit biblical position. It's clearly implied. One example for me, I think, is the mandate for parents to provide godly education under parental supervision, under their supervision. This means that supporting the establishment, I think, of biblical-based, Bible-based education and criticizing learning that proceeds on atheistic or even agnostic presuppositions is biblically objective journalism. Because we do not proceed from the presupposition that there is no God, and there's plenty of education that does. And so we argue against that. Now, that's not to say we argue for homeschool exclusivity or public or private school exclusivity or public school exclusivity, but we argue for a deep and meaningful engagement by the parents for whatever educational method they choose for their children. And I have friends who are in all three, and I've talked through even going to public school for friends and how they seek to teach their children and all that. And that's another discussion for another time. But I think this is one example. I think this helps us, even though there's no explicit injunction for parents to place their children in Christian or home schools, I mean, a story on this issue would not condemn public schools because the Bible doesn't anticipate that the way we see it today. But it would admonish parents to closely supervise their children's education while supplementing it with biblical and Christian worldview teaching in the home. And so that's how, my friends who choose public schools, that's fine. Tim Challies, I remember, gave many of you read Tim Challies, and Tim's a friend of mine, and we've talked about this issue, and Tim very thoughtfully put his children in Canadian public schools, even though there are some presuppositions there he doesn't like, but he teaches his children, and so it was a very thoughtful approach. And so, I don't think that's beyond the reach of Christians, so that's not what I'm saying, but this is the clearly implicit biblical position on that, just as an exemplary issue, is the mandate for parents to provide theological supervision of the education. I think many rapids fall within class one or two, because the Reformation gave us this great doctrine called the perspicuity. That's a big word, a hard word to say sometimes, I always stumble. The perspicuity of Scripture, which means if we read the Bible faithfully and accurately, then we should be able to apply it accurately, understand it accurately to most of life's issues. And that takes rigorous work. You're here, many of you here doing biblical studies, you're learning to do this, to apply theological rigor, academic rigor to the task of biblical interpretation and application. So this doesn't come easy necessarily. So class three. In this class, partisans of both sides quote Scripture, but careful study allows biblical conclusions. I think an example of one issue is the gender debate. I believe that the Bible very clearly teaches complementarianism. And I've been an editor with CBMW for the last 9 years and remain on staff there and do some teaching for them from time to time because I believe the Bible clearly teaches that. As Ligon Duncan once said, if you don't get complementarianism out of the Bible, then you won't get anything. And I think that's true, even though both sides of the issue quote the Bible. I think it demonstrates complementarianism very clearly. Other examples, poverty-fighting issues. Partisans of the left talk of God's preferential option for the poor. But I think a biblical understanding of justice means full rights for both the poor and the rich, all social classes. I don't think the Bible clearly teaches that God is making a new people, and it's neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free. We're all one in Christ. So the God's new ethnos is very different. And so that's what we're to articulate and uphold. And so not that the virtuous poor or the virtuous rich. I mean, those are neither here nor there. And so I think the preferential option for the poor or the rich, as conservatives sometimes rightly are panned with believing, are both wrong headed. Biblically, the poor should be given the opportunity to glean, but challenged to work. I mean, I think the notion of don't give them a fish, but teach them. Give them a fish, but then teach them to fish. Compassionate conservatism, I think that finds a pretty clear one in Scripture, I believe, and that will be what helps. So Marvin Alasky has written a book called Compassionate Conservatism, and he was an advisor to George W. Bush on his conservative policies on that issue, and I think he's right. I think it's biblical. He's very, very thoughtful in his expression of that, and that's what I consider myself is a compassionate conservative with that particular understanding. Not that, as we said in the hallway, a couple guys were talking about, I'm a conservative, but I'm a nice guy. I'm not a jerk. Don't know what that means, you know. So we always knew you were nice. That's not what I mean, but compassionate means we give them a fish and then we take them and teach them how to fish so they can feed themselves because that's what Scripture anticipates working people. Class four, a biblical understanding backed by historical evidence. Example here would be limited government. I mean, nowhere does the Bible really explicitly mandate limited government. But I think there are places like 1 Samuel 8, for example, that describe the dangers of a human kingship. And I think it's clearly bad theology to see government as the savior in areas such as health care or really any other area. I mean, Calvin, if you read Calvin on government and on justice within government and on just leaders and accountability and democracy, I think Calvin's coming out of these presuppositions. This is how he saw Geneva being this city that was driven by this democratic impulse of, but always lashed to Scripture. Now I think our democratic impulse is there's some of that in our constitutional democracy, but then you know there is an Enlightenment notion of individualism that we've got to be very, very careful not to embrace that's not necessarily biblical. So, again, you see how you have to really think through this carefully because history demonstrates when government is the savior that there's never a good result. Never. It never works. It always comes down to the government of the few, the power of the few. It unwittingly creates the very problem it seeks to solve, I think. But again, we read the Bible in terms of Genesis 3, and we're not surprised at that at all. Class 5, a biblical sense of human nature. Here, there's no biblical mandate or not a clear historical trail, but there are certain understandings of the fallenness of human nature that can be brought to bear. I mean, as Jesus, you know, he didn't give himself to any man because he knew what was in man. Well, we know what's in man because we have our Bibles open, that man is totally depraved. An example is those who believe that man is inherently good and tend towards being a lover of peace. Well, they will emphasize negotiations and disarmament, diplomacy of a different kind than maybe others who have a biblical worldview will emphasize diplomacy and negotiations and disarmament. Because the biblical understanding of sin leads to some very tough questions, I think. Like, what if war is the natural result of sin? I mean, should we have been involved in Europe in the late 30s and 1940s? I think the answer is clearly yes. Or should we have been with the peaceniks and said, you know, make love, not war? No, I think it's clearly right that the Allies were involved in Europe and in the Pacific in World War II. My father was a World War II veteran, and so I'm not just a hawk who likes to fight, as we're sometimes, sometimes charged with. But no, I think there are just war categories that stretch all the way back to Augustine, Aquinas, others in the early church who've answered this question. If wars are a natural result of sin, post-fall mankind, then we can, you know, then just society should involve themselves in that to liberate the powerless from the tyranny of the powerful. So another question, what if some leaders, you know, see war as a useful way to gain more power and the belief they can achieve victory without overwhelming losses? Just questions like that. I mean, history is full of mistaken calculations of that sort also. I mean, so both sides are true. Sometimes it's not a good idea to go to war, is it? We've seen in this country when it maybe wasn't such a good idea, and I don't know about the war in Iraq, I'm not weighing in on that, or even I don't have anything in mind specifically, but, you know, there might not be, this is where we could agree maybe with some of our peace-loving friends, that it's not a good idea to go to war. I mean, the way we carried out the war in Vietnam, and at least the military policy, was very wrong-headed, I think. But sometimes, you know, we may plunge ahead. We may plunge ahead in that, and we need to think biblically about that. If we don't assume a benign human nature concerning, say, warfare, we need to plan for military preparedness and raise the cost of war to potential aggressors. Because we have to have an army. This is why we have an army, and I think it's right for us to have an army, because we live in a post-Genesis 3 world. It's not sinful. Again, John Lennon would not agree with this, but I do not agree with John Lennon. I mean, it's not, unfortunately, mankind is not basically inherently good. And so we can't imagine a world. We're not going to be able to imagine. The world he imagines is only brought in by the gospel, isn't it? Only brought in by Christ when his kingdom, the kingdom of Christ, crushes the kingdom of man. So we can think about the nature of man when doing our news, when we write about these things and assess these things. Finally, class 6, this one is navigable by only by experts who themselves might be overturned, use our rafting analogy here. Here there is no clear biblical position, no historical trail to use for discernment, and not much else to mark our paths. And an example I think I have here is the North American Free Trade Agreement in 1994, when George H.W. Bush went out of office, that sent a lot of our manufacturing to other countries, unfortunately. But there wasn't a clear biblical position on that. There were principles, so we needed to look to some economic experts to help us with that. So those are the 6 rapids, you know, to help us kind of to assess how we want to proceed with a story. And sometimes we may say, there's no story here. Well, we really can't do a story here. This is not helpful. I think a lot of the stories that are done, certainly today, just they're drivel. They have no point. And even Christian stories, there's just no real point to it. I mean, God's not really glorified. There's just no real point to it. Like I said, the gospel mimes is kind of a funny example. And I know the heart behind that's not. I don't want to impugn the heart behind that. I know the heart behind that's something good. Steve?
I mean, today it's not so much gospel mimes as much as gospel marketers.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. Because even in my last years with a daily paper in Georgia, we talk about we have to do this story to please X advertiser to get to market certain things. So there were lots of just stories we hated as reporters having to do them. But even they would, our managing editor would be honest and say, we're just trying to sort of kiss up to so and so because he's a big advertiser, because we have to market. So it was money driven. I mean, yeah, I had to do many stories like that, and they were easy. You could do them in just 30 minutes and spin it out. There you go. So I didn't like them. Those weren't my clip files, but no, there's a lot of that. That's, you know, media is market driven today. Again, the competition, and now the internet. I mean, it's insane. And newspapers, yeah, they've largely given up. They've tried to, you know, I write a story for the Courier Journal. They go online before it went in the paper. So why subscribe? I subscribed to the Birmingham newspaper for an insanely low. I think I paid like $15 for 6 months. You know, in the old days, that would have set me back a couple hundred dollars to have a whole year of it. Now it's like $30. Because why buy that? I just like to carry it with me in my bag, and if I'm somewhere, I can read it. And I know I can look at it on my iPhone. I'm just not quite used to that. So anyway, but that's a really good point. So biblically directed reporting, which is what I'm arguing for here, versus Fox News. Okay, you guys like that. Definitions and methodology. Christian journalists in situations where the Bible shows us the right path, and I think it does so most of the time, should reject both the theory, and you're going to, some of you like this, some of you don't like it, the farce of the Fox News slogan, fair and balanced coverage. I mean, do you really think their coverage is fair and balanced? Who thinks their coverage is fair and balanced? Anybody? That's why I think it's a farce. I think it's a farce for the other side to say this too. It was a farce for my professors to say this in college. And it is a farce to say fair and balanced, I think. Because the Christian worldview is not fair and balanced on most issues. I remember I got into a debate with one of the officials at one of our denominational press agencies one time over a story. Someone put pressure on, they weren't going to run a story. And I made the case for running the story because he wanted to be fair and balanced. And I made the argument that we have a Bible open in our laps and we're not fair and balanced. And so they ran the story. I wrote a lengthy, polemic against why. I think I just wore him out. It's okay. I want to put Robinson's story back up here. He's driving me crazy. But no, I think fair and balanced, we're not fair and balanced. We don't give both sides of the issue when Scripture is clear because that's not fair and balanced as Christians in seeking to articulate the good news. Olasky says, biblically, there is no neutrality. Either we are God-centered or man-centered. Christian reporters should give equal space to a variety of perspectives only when the Bible is unclear. Okay, we're going to do a story on eschatology. I've done one of those here. Great, we did. Okay, that's there's a lot of perspectives on there. A lot of good men disagree. But he says a solidly Christian news publication should be provocative, evocative, colorful, gripping, Bible-based news analysis. And I think that's exactly what Journal World does. And even what we try to do here with our magazine, of course, we're more theologically focused, but we sought to really engage these things and took this approach, and I think our guys still do. Again, a solidly Christian news publication should be provocative, evocative, colorful, gripping, Bible-based news analysis. Now, we've really ratcheted up the colorful. I'm thankful because it used to be just a bunch of writers here, and thankfully Dan Dumas and others saw the need for us to be more attractive, and they read well, and they look good today, and I like that. I think it's liberating for a Christian reporter to be able to openly proceed based upon his or her presuppositions. I don't have to sort of try to get both sides and make sure I'm representing, every tribe and tongue and nation in this story. Like at Gannett, they had a point system for every reporter. And I would have to go out and find three or four different ethnicities for every story if I could. It was called mainstreaming. And if I did a story on banking and I had a white banker, I'd have to find a black banker and I would have to put under my story, this man quoted in the seventh paragraph is the black man. And so I would do that. And what's really hilarious about this is one day that line did not get edited out and it got in the paper. And rightly so, the African-American community was outraged that we would patronize. And I loved it because I thought, that's exactly what conservatives are saying, that we're patronizing you. And so they descended upon the paper, and it was great. And they wrote Washington, where Gannett was located. I thought, this is great. This shows the knucklehead approach to this kind of journalism. But we all had points, and I was on a beat that... I was on a beat for a while where there's just, it was pretty, uniform in terms of race. And I was always getting written, they're always sitting down and talking to me. And I had some kind of bias. I said, I just can't find a guy on the street and say, hey, since you're X person, what do you think about this? Because I'm trying to put you in the story. I'm trying to, let you guys have your... I said, that's a lot more racist than the very... I think you're creating the very thing you're seeking to remedy here. And so the black community did too. I loved it. I don't know... I think they continue that policy, but they're a lot quieter about it. But it got in the paper. I loved it. Someone got fired over that too, and it was great. So, God's truth abideth still. biblically directed reporting, both parts. Again, I said those are intentional terms. Biblically directed, biblical direction, and detailed reporting are essential to understanding this concept fully. And I think a lot of publications today fail. Okay, they are biblically directed, they're not detailed in the reporting, or they're detailed in reporting and not biblically directed. They fall out of balance here. A directed reporting article is factually accurate and based on solid research, but it has a clear point of view and an emphasis on showing rather than telling. And that's, if I could write something on the board, and I'll do that, showing versus telling. This is what we're going to spend a lot of our time on the rest of the day. Showing versus telling. I always tell my students that write me a paper that shows me and doesn't so much tell me, because that's just an opinion piece typically. But if you prove it, be a good attorney. Show me why this holds water or doesn't. Show me why this person is guilty or not guilty. I think all writing should be typified by this, and you can't do this without a good reporting of facts. Whether you're writing a paper here or writing a news story, you can't write around poor reporting and poor fact gathering. So that's the key, showing versus telling. And I think this is important, biblically directed reporting in particular. Because showing is how we demonstrate the view for which we are arguing. I mean, this is not direct editorializing. This is very different. I mean, direct editorializing is telling me. And that's just a talking head. Usually, you know, the blowhards on the news stations, that's what they're doing. They're just telling you, endlessly telling you, you know, to the point where, you know, you can't get mad anymore. You just want, okay, I'm going to turn this off and go read a book, do something else with my time. Because they're not showing me anything. But what you're doing is wedding Christian worldview with precise, tough-minded reporting of specific detail to make the case for your thesis or point of your story. Your story should argue a Christian thesis, I think. And without you saying, my thesis is, which I had to do in my dissertation, and I was very contrary to my nature, but I did it because I had to do that. And you should in a dissertation, right, Ryan? There you go. You know you're about to do that. But, you know, I show by the details of the story, the good, robust reporting, tough-minded reporting, what it is that I'm trying to tell. And I think World, again, does this better than anyone. I mean, this is atypical in Christian journalism today because it's time-intensive, it takes a lot of work, and it's a lot easier to kind of pontificate about the decline of the economy or the price of gas or something like that than it is to hit the streets and interview people who've been affected by the price of gasoline or the declining economy. It takes a lot more time. It takes a lot more work to hit the pavement and dig. And there's sometimes, I think, a reluctance to merge opinion. Oleski says this in reporting, even though the opinion in direct reporting comes through the selection of specific detail, and it has long been recognized that all reporters inevitably select. So make no mistake about it. The liberals do this every single day. I did it. Every time I sat down to write a news story, when I worked in secular media, I had a whole notebook full of stuff. They said, write 400 words. And so I chose to put some stuff in there and not other stuff. And so what was important to me might not be important to the lady reporter sitting next to me who was a liberal. So, lo and behold, there's no real objectivity. I mean, you don't just sort of put it in a blender and, okay, spit it out. This is what's going to go in. It's just at random. No, there's facts that we leave out. There's the ellipses. You know, you have the ellipses and you wonder, what was in there? You know, somebody cut something out of this quote in an ellipses. You have the three dots and you think, I always wonder, what was in there? Because I use ellipses in my dissertation and other things. But I can't help but wonder. I love footnotes. I don't like endnotes because I'm always having to, turn back. But I love footnotes because I want to know where this came from. Where did you get this? What is this? And what those three dots, what was in there? Biblical objectivity does not emphasize personal opinion. But the goal is perspective grounded in the biblical worldview. It's not your opinion, but it's perspective grounded in a biblical worldview. You're getting this here. You're being equipped here at Southern Seminary to articulate this very thing. So I want a lot of good writers and reporters to come out of Southern Seminary with this robust theological education. Good theologians and good writers. But if there is insufficient biblical rationale for a story, then you toss it out. We don't have biblical rationale for this story, toss it out. That's what they do at World Magazine, and I think that's right. Because a Christian publication should teach, but it should teach by effectively showing rather than telling. Directed reporting is designed to show readers the salient facts in biblical-based, Bible-based contextualization and allow them to agree or disagree with the conclusions reached. And this differs from reporting that picks a fact here and there. Kind of here, okay, here's a bunch of stuff in my notebook. I'll put this in here. Boy, I don't have room for that. That's good. And so we just put that in there based on usually space. Now, there's not as many ads in newspapers anymore, so I imagine they have a lot of space. The cry used to be write really tight, short stories for the front page. I don't know that that's true anymore. But it also differs from what you might call theoretical reporting that does not have a base in pavement-pounding reporting. I mean, I did a lot of reporting by phone calls when I was a reporter. for Gannett and others. They didn't challenge us to go out and hit the streets, although some of them did. But of course, we always had to get both views. So I think this is what we would call properly Christian journalism. It's not church news. It's not triumphalistic in the sense that look at what we've done. Look at how we kind of have our best life now here. Whatever it is, I mean, the gospel mimes, the marketing mentality, all those things are in a lot of what passes for Christian journalism. And I think World, and there are blogs that do this well now. I mean, I think the blogosphere has really helped with some of this because there's you can't hide behind bad reporting so much anymore. That's been a good thing. So that's biblically directed reporting. I want to go into our next subject. I'll take just a minute for questions or comments about that before we. I love good feedback. So if we're going to the fundamentals of news writing, that's sort of the rationale. Again, orthodoxy before orthopraxy. James. I will give the six rabbits again happily. Do you have it on? Okay, you should have it on the handout. Okay, I gave you a lot of this, so you won't have to just blitz through here and take notes. Okay. Okay.
Tom Rainer's books. Was transformational church now, and then they had the one who is high expectation church. He does a lot of research, contacts a lot of people. Is that what you're talking about? Getting a lot of information to support your point?
Sure. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I haven't read a lot of time. I've read, when I first came to Southern, a couple of the books I haven't. But yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing. And we apply it to the news side. I mean, Tom's trying to prove there, what's wrong with the church and how we can remedy it. Good, wonderful pursuit. And I think the Rainer Group does good research. I know he's trying to do away with a lot of the pragmatic, methods of research. And Tom's trying to be a bit of a reformer there. I know he was in his time here. He was dean of the Billy Graham School when I was an MDiv student. And my wife is actually Tom's secretary. So I think he's trying to compile good information to make a case for something. So, yeah. Again, this is applied to news and to proclaim the gospel. But, yeah, that's kind of something similar. This will be a little bit of a different shade with news reporting. Well, let's talk about news writing, the fundamentals. We've kind of got the rationale. Again, we like to set the prolegomena up front. Did we get copies of this, Josh? Or were they able to... Okay, oh, good, good, excellent. You have copies of the fundamentals. I just gave you, we have the copy, sent her to copy these this morning, so you kind of look through this with me, and you'll have these. You won't have to just break your hands taking notes. Usually I have this on a PowerPoint, but I had a computer hard drive crash a few days ago, and it is gone with the wind, apparently. I did not have that backed up, I guess. So gathering the news, and this is very important. The first step, gathering the news. You're going out, okay, Steve takes you on as a freelancer, and you're going to go out and gather news. That's very, very important. You're not going to sit in your office and pontificate. You're going to go out and prove something, right? This is the first step. And reporting, of course, you might be covering meetings or lectures here. You'll be sitting through lectures, meetings. I mean, we cover the trustee meetings here at Southern Seminary. I sat through an endless variety as a newspaper reporter. City council meetings, board of education meetings, and I always took books with me because a lot of that wasn't pertinent to anybody and would bore anyone to death. But I was usually there for a reason. But different stories of the same approach. I mean, the key elements that will kind of constitute the news. And here's my cardinal rule. This is a cardinal rule I'm sure I got from somewhere else, but it's become my cardinal rule. You cannot write around bad reporting with flowery words. And I see that is the besetting sin of young reporters. They get a little information, and then they try to write around it a lot of flowery prose. But you can't do that and make a compelling article, especially in a biblical, trying to articulate a biblical worldview, I don't think. I think too much information is a good thing. So get far more than you will use. You will. If you cover a lecture, you're going to get the lecture, and you're going to summarize the lecture. That's a good. They used to do a lot of those stories. Not so much anymore, but you're going to summarize that and probably now link to it. A couple hundred words and link to it now. So I was very glad when we started linking to those and not have to, transcribe lots of lectures and those things. And I'm sure you guys are too. We could sort of link. Here's a summary and link to it so you can listen to it yourself if you want. There's two basic types of stories within the genre of news writing. There's hard news story, and that's first day stories such as crime or tragedies, economic news, or at SBTS, a sermon or theology stories. I mean, 9/11, you know, what you saw on 9/12 was first day stories from 9/11 because people were still learning what happened. There wasn't a lot of analysis yet because we didn't know what was going on, but we knew these towers fell, these planes hit it, somebody tied to this group seemed to do it, and a lot of people taking credit for it in here, and this is what we know. First day lead. We just, you know, it was, you just write the stuff up front. That's the hard news story. Hard news has a hard news lead, a first paragraph. A feature story. This is a profile of a person or an institution, an event. Southern, it might be a story on a student, student missions involvement, or profiles. We do these in the student, the tie, or the seminary magazine. We profile a professor. I did a great, a fun story once on Michael Haken, how he was once a Marxist. And he took me through all that, and it was, you know, it was compelling, fun, a lot of fun to read. And I did another story on a student who wrote a hit country song, great hit country song about 6 or 7 years ago. And now he had launched a very promising songwriting career, but he left it all. He gave it up. Katrina intervened in his life at New Orleans. He came here and left it all for the gospel ministry. Made a wonderful, wonderful story, but a feature story. And then my lead wasn't, you know, the stuff, just who, what, when, where with him. There's a blending of two in many stories, the two, sports stories or news features, things like that. Again, this is Journalism 101, the fundamentals, why I'm calling it that. The information you gather will be different, but the basic truth is the same. Get good information and get too much of it. But, I mean, the nature of the information might be a little different whether it's a hard news story or a feature story. You have to ask the right questions. We'll talk about interviewing later, a bit later if we get to it, and we will, I think. I think you have a handout if we don't. But begin to formulate your thesis, which in the news business is called a nut graph. And everyone does this. World does this. New York Times does this. All God's children in the news business do this. There's not a better way to do this. The nut graph, which will either be your lead. Depends on whether you're writing a hard news story or a feature story. But you should be able to write the thesis or the summary of your story in one sentence. Now, this won't be your lead, but I would do this in my head. After so many years, I'd go out on a news story or, you know, a ball game or whatever I'd covered, or I'd cover the Georgia General Assembly. I would sit, and I'd try to come up, and sometimes I would type this. Like, what's this about? What's the nub in about 15 to 25 words? What's my story going to be about? Because if you can't do that, then you're not going to know what your story is about. It's kind of like, it's like preaching, a great exercise or teaching. You don't know what the thesis is, and your editor is going to come back to you with a story and say, you know, this isn't very good, isn't focused. Of course, you're writing a short story, and I think all good writing is focused. Even if it's a book, it's going to have a thesis. You should be able to go into a book. How many of you have read Mortimer Adler's book about how to read a book? That's a wonderful book, but there should be a place you could go and say, here's what the book's about. And if you're a PhD student in church history here, you will have to do that, won't you, Ryan, to do your 1,000 pages of reading a week and tell them with some degree of truthfulness you did it and be able to give Greg Wills the thesis, because he'll ask you for the thesis. But you should be able to go in there and say, here it is, in a sentence, or come up with a sentence. And so it is with your writing. Here's some examples I have here. A chapel story. The doctrine of hell is rejected often today, even by many so-called evangelical Christians, but Southern Baptists must stand firm in teaching it as a core biblical truth. R. Albert Mohler, Jr., left the Jr. outside on Larry King Live last night. We always write stories when he's on Larry King Live or something like that. But you should, you know, coming back here, say, okay, that's what it's about. And usually that's going to be pretty clear because, you know, he's on there. I mean, Dr. Mohler and Joel Osteen and Rob Bell and somebody else on hell, you know, the sort of the three views of hell among Christians or whatever. And that's going to be kind of easy, but it's not always like that. And here's a nut graph of Adam Dorsey. This was a student, a Master Divinity student at Southern Seminary. Wants to give his life to full-time gospel ministry, even though he wrote one of the most popular country music songs of the past 10 years. I remember I interviewed him for several hours and talked to some people in Nashville. I really spent a lot of time on that, but I had to sit down and go, okay, I've got this mountain of stuff. What am I really wanting to say here? Well, that's what I want to say. But I want to show that. I didn't want to just, and I would say that somewhere, but I would spend all the rest of the story showing, okay, here's, he left it. And I even came up, I remember as a, I'm an old, Russ Moore and I, Russ is a good friend, and Russ is Cross in the Jukebox series is right up my alley. I like the old twangy country music that makes my wife sick. But I love that music. But my paradigm was crying, loving, and leaving. Those are my categories. It just fell out that way. It was perfect how his testimony was partly crying, partly loving, and then partly leaving because he left the business. And so that's in a good country music song. I think that was my lead about how everyone who knows good country music knows those are three elements are in any good country song. And so that was what his story was. It was kind of crying, loving, and leaving. Now, all stories don't fall out that easily, but his just really did. After I came up the nut graph and said, how can I get at this in kind of a compelling and even, I mean, somewhat, not light way, but, you know, a more compelling and less serious way. Then that was it. I mean, a little humor can be good at times, and I think I quoted George Jones or somebody. Anyway, I don't remember, but I do remember that's how I approached the story. But that was my nut graph, because here's what it's going to be about. Because if it isn't clear in my head, as I write through the story, and this was about a 1,500, 2,000-word story, you can really get lost. And you'll go through there, and your dissertation's the same way. If you're writing a dissertation, mine was 312 pages. So you just had every day, because I was facing David Puckett, who's a stickler about papers and staying on focused. And so I would always ask myself, is this serving the thesis? And through a story, say, am I helping make the main point here? Especially in something short, a shorter work. It should always serve the main thesis or the point of the story, as you summarized in your nut graph there. And there's essentially three parts of a news story. And this is a good outline for almost any kind of writing. You sort of tell them what you're going to tell them, you tell them, you tell them what you told them. Right? There's really not a better way to communicate than that. I mean, that'll preach. And if you preach that way, your people will get it. I kind of preach the way I wrote news stories. It's very helpful. There was a very easy transfer to me over from writing news stories to writing sermons because it helped me to be, I hope. Now, my people may laugh at that and say, that's what he thinks. They're probably better asked that, or my wife, but I'm glad they're not here to refute me. I can be exemplary in every way that way. So anyway, the lead, the first part, is the lead. And this is one of the most important parts of the story. This is from an old, David Roach is not here. I will lecture on different types of leads later. David's one of our former news writers here. Here's the first axiom of leads. Perfect is often the enemy of the good. I mean, don't wait for divine inspiration. You're not going to get it. You're not an apostle. Okay, right, guys? You'll sit. We had a Towers editor, one of my dearest friends in the world. I won't name him to protect the guilty. He's a professor today, Old Testament professor. But he would prayer walk this campus. He would prayer walk this campus for a lead, and we would just say, just write a lead, you know. And I was his. I would be waiting for his well-crafted prose to arrive at my desk, and finally say, sit him down and say, just settle for a single here. You don't have to hit a home run. And he was a great lead writer, but it would take him, he once told me he took 7 hours on thinking through a lead. I'm like, that's unacceptable. So I didn't put 7 hours into any part of my dissertation, probably. I mean, in one little section of it. Don't tell Dr. Nettles that. I've got the degree, and there's no turning back now. So, yeah, if I'm going on record of saying that, but he knows that because he read my dissertation. He probably laughed about it. Said, yeah, I've got a passing, but this isn't good. Anyway, but perfect is often the enemy of good. Because you're trying to write the perfect lead. You really want divine inspiration. You want, you know, Galatians 2:20 right there on the great verse, right there on the, no. No, just a good, I mean, look for a good beginning, not the perfect lead. Here's a tip. Generally, it is better to rough out the article, then come back and wrestle with the lead. And that may sound counterintuitive, but this will help you if you're writing a longer paper, because sometimes I'd write the second half of an MDiv paper and then write the first half, because this is the way I think. But if you get stuck and the cursor's blinking, you know this feeling? I write every day, and there are times I hate the cursor. You know, like this thing just won't produce any words. Just blinking. But then I'll soon get really frustrated and write something. Just get the clay on the wheel and start to, because you can mold the clay. I've got a friend, it took one of my friends 10 years to write his dissertation because he was scared to death of Greg Wills, and he was scared to death to write. And finally, I took him aside. We talked one day. I said, you just have to write some words on that page, and it will go from there. You'll run downhill. And he did. And pretty soon, wow, in about 2 years, he finished his dissertation. This doesn't have to be Hamlet. This is your dissertation. Just write it. Tom Schreiner said it's the worst thing he's ever written. Ask him. He always told me, oh, my dissertation's terrible. I go back and go, ugh, and I read that. I've put mine away. I just don't even want to think about that thing anymore. But it's better to sort of rough out the article, because this will keep you from constructing a lead that does not have any obvious connection to the remainder of the story. I saw a great, awful lead, and we'll go into this here in a moment. in my, I love my local hometown paper in Georgia is brutal, and I always use it for this class because it's the most obvious example of poor journalism. And you know, he had a lead one day. The editor did, said, "Who, what, where, and when?" And then it was like, "The sorghum festival in Blairsville proceeded yesterday without a hitch." And I thought, "Whoa, whoa, whoa!" Well, I thought something had gotten in there from, you know, kind of like accidentally, but I have no idea. And then about the eighth graph, he came back to the, "Oh, you remember that question I asked up there? If you have to point back to that, you know, you've not done a good job." But I mean, that was what it was. And I just thought, wow, that's really bad. And I used it for this class, but unfortunately, I've lost that article. But perfect is often the enemy of good. You're searching for the right thing, but just get a good start. Let's look at some examples here. I just can't resist. Take out this very small print paper. And you'll see things to avoid. I thought, let's see things to avoid. Just keep that in your hand. And things to avoid in the leaves, and we'll get back to that because I'll give you some examples here. Cliches. You know, most cliches were just really stupid the first time they were uttered. They weren't clever at all the first time someone said them, you know? I had an editor who loved when I covered baseball. He hated cliches. And so he would come in at 4 o'clock in the morning, and he would edit my Braves story first because I'd filed it usually at 2, you know. And so he'd come in. So I decided to have a little fun with him once, and I wrote two stories. And I sent one to him, and then I had a note like, ha-ha, here's really my story. So he had some major anger issues, and it's kind of fun to get him stirred up. I know, that's very sinful. But he had some major anger. But anyway, and I told a buddy of mine who was there, so just watch this. And so I wrote, "How do the Braves spell relief?" Which he just would go through the ceiling at any kind of cliche like that. And I spelled like whoever the relief pitcher's was name, and he just absolutely flipped out. It was, you know, I mean, God has probably made me pay for that. That was, you know, wasn't really living with the Lord in those days maybe or something. I don't know. But anyway, because, and of course, he really got a kick later, said, "That was pretty good. You got me on that. I lost it." Threw my clipboard, uttered a few unspeakable words, and which, you know, it was not pretty par for the course. But anyway, you know, most cliches just weren't even clever the first time they were uttered, typically. So cliches, they don't communicate anything. I mean, all cliches are inappropriate all the time, unless you say, as an old cliche says. You can say that, but point out it's a cliche. Wordiness. A good lead is between 10 and 35 words. I mean, Ephesians 1 is not your example for a lead. Paul, let's break the Greek up some there, buddy. I mean, you know, but Paul's an inspired writer. We're not. That is a perfect, perfect paragraph. I can't write Ephesians 1 perfectly. It'll be a run-on sentence. Something's going to happen when the uninspired guy tries to write an Ephesians 1 type paragraph. I've seen it tried, and the reporter didn't live to tell the story. So don't don't do that. Cuteness. And you know this, clever is wonderful. Cute is not wonderful. And there's a world of difference between clever and cute. And you see cute. David Roach brought his sweet something sweet for Valentine's Day. That's cute, but that isn't clever. But now here's somewhat clever. Erin Roach can often be seen driving her SUV with a stubborn donkey sitting next to her on the front seat. No, it's not her husband David, but a mule colt that her animal clinic specializes in caring for. Well, that's kind of clever. I kind of like that. I would read. That comes from a story adapted from a story that I actually read about an animal doctor who specialized in mules. So that drew me in. It's somewhat clever, but it's not something sweet for his suite. Lead disconnect. Never write a lead that has nothing whatsoever to do with the rest of the story. It's possible to write a pretty lead that does not connect with the bulk of the articles. And we're going to see that here in a minute, I think. And the use of passive voice. Try to write mostly in active voice. So here we go. Here's your North Georgia News. Let's just look at the lead story here. And I just took the one from this week. Okay. Allison Outdoor Advertising, this is the city of Blairsville, is the lead. And no one lives in Blairsville here, do they? They're going to tell this guy that I read this. But Allison Outdoor Advertising, LP, has filed a petition in the Superior Court of Union County to writ of certiorari complaint for declaratory judgment, mandamus, and damages against the city of Blairsville, Georgia, and as if we don't know we're in Georgia, and Rhonda Mahan, Bob Wood, Jane Thompson, Buddy Moore, and Tony Dyer in their official capacities as the city council members, the defendants, and Blairsville City Council respondent, and a partridge in a pear tree. What's wrong with that lead? Does violate everything I've said here? First of all, never use writ of certiorari and put defendant. I was thinking as an editor, what would I do with this? I'd be, go back, this, here. My first lead, my editor, I was 19 at the Daily Paper I went to work for, and he wadded my story up and hit me in the head with it. And so I think that's what I would do here. I wouldn't. I'm a Christian, and I would show him. What's that?
Maybe Norman Cooper was a little overworked.
Yeah, I think he was overworked. I mean, that's it. Just let's go home. I mean, but he says, let's go home here, right? We've said what we need to say. We've got the writ of a complaint for declaratory judgment, mandamus, and damages against the city of Blairsville, Georgia, I guess, in case you forget where you are. And Rhonda Mahan, Joe, Bob Wood, and Jane Thompson, and Buddy Moore, and Tony Dyer. I mean, let's get, and my mama, and, you know, everyone else in here, and their official capacities. I mean, do you need to say their official capacities as city councilman? I mean, just say city councilman. And Blairsville City Council, the respondent. I have no idea what that says. Somebody got in trouble, I think. And that might have been a better lead. I went to the meeting last night, and Blairsville's in big trouble. I'd read that and go, wow, they're in big trouble. What's that? What's the trouble? Well, the trouble is this lead, as far as I can tell, right now. A writ of certiorari means an order by a higher court directing. I mean, he explains it, but if you have to explain all the legalese, don't use the legalese. Just explain it. Explain it a lot. Let's see what else is on here. Okay, here we go. Wastewater treatment facility. Those are always riveting stories. I've written a lot of those. This is what everybody has been waiting to hear, said Ken Smith, wastewater treatment plant operator for the city of Blairsville, when he gave his report to the mayor and city council. Now, is there any context? There's a little context missing here, right? And I'm excited about wastewater so far, but I don't see any wastewater in that lead. But everyone's going to be waiting to hear about wastewater, is what I take away from that. And there's just no antecedent here. And it's a quote. You usually don't use leads and quotes in the lead unless you give some kind of context. Again, with my apologies, I know I'm not trying to be, maybe I am being, maybe this is part of my sanctification. And I do know this man, and he is a nice man. I know that. But this isn't nice journalism. So these are wordy. They're very wordy. They explain. They use a lot of obfuscate language. It just obfuscates, right? I mean, never use legal terms like this. Never use theological terms if you're writing for your church. Use them, but don't just start with, you know, propitiation. Use that word. Teach your people that word, but teach them in the body of the story somewhere. You know, Christ died for sinners. Boy, there's a lead. Died in the place of sinners. Now, that's good. You know, Christ dies a propitiation. That's good, too. But let's go into the story and explain what that means. I mean, so I think that's what, again, I'm sorry. It's just funny. The writ of certiorari, all this stuff, I just thought, wow. You know, I can always count on this to be like this. He wrote. Well, the thing, he appears, it's like, my paper is Where's Waldo, because he's always in it somewhere himself. So it's Where's Norman? He really does. He usually has a picture of Norman somewhere else, usually receiving some kind of award and for wordy journalism or something. Because, brother, you won it, if this is the case. So anyway, I don't know. But this is just a good example, and we'll come back to this. So, I mean, there's passive voice there. Lead disconnect. Again, the first story, you've said everything you need to say. All those legal terms, just let's go have lunch, because I've said everything I need to say. It's not cute. But it's very wordy. I don't know how many words, but usually 10 to 35 words, and the shorter the better. We'll get into lead writing a bit later this afternoon. I don't know if there's lead disconnect, because I wouldn't read any further, because I got everything I need. I got the writ of certiorari. But you don't want to tell the whole story in the lead either. And I think that's kind of what you're trying to do. There was a story about a local citizen killed in a car wreck in this paper once, and the people were deeply offended. They sued the paper because of his... really callous. He'd taken the police report and just printed the police report on the front of the paper, all of the legal jargon and stuff. And it looked basically like this teenager of a prominent man had gone out and gotten tanked and run over something. I mean, it really looked bad. I mean, these are things you have to be really careful with this. I mean, you can get in a lot of trouble writing for a newspaper. My roommate in college was sued, and boy, for $200,000 or $300,000 for something he had in his lead. He didn't back up, and the plaintiff won. And it cost the newspaper about $300,000, or the insurance company, it cost him his job. And he works for the AJC today, so that's probably going to make you feel better about the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. So the lead, we'll come back to that, the body. Many stories start well, they have good leads, but they become mushy in the middle. There's no sequence of ideas and sensations. There's no pattern of cause and effect. There's no narrative, no pearls, as the last he says, just puddles. You should give pearls all through your story so they keep reading. It's like, you know, it's like a path or lighting a path or, you know, it's like a ladder, just a rung. Wow, this is good. They just want to keep reading. Keep reading. You can start well, but when they get everything they need in the lead, you know, we've not done our job. We want them to read on. Here is where you constantly turn your nut graph or your lead and remember that it is your task to convey information in support of that point. Just ask yourself every step of the way, what is my point? Is it tied to this? I have deleted lots of paragraphs or rewrote lots of paragraphs because they didn't support my point. They didn't support my lead or my nut graph. My nut graph, you see that there. We've already kind of talked about that. But here's a few pointers for writing the body of a story. Just keep thinking of your readers and help them by relating the unknown to the known. So again, you don't want to have to make them go back and say, now, what was the connection to the writ of Sir? I don't know. No, you connect the known to the unknown. For example, faraway place X is like nearby place Y. Example, Jeremy Haiti, where Garrett Wishall serves, as a Haitian landmass, is about the size of Louisville. In population, it's about the size of New York City. It's a good point of reference there. I like that. That gives you, okay, you'll see that sometimes. A landmass about the size of the state of Rhode Island. You know, wow, that's pretty small. You know, comparisons like that. But all through the story, keep going back to your point of reference. B, do not overuse confusing statistics or technical information. Translate jargon into English. Now, seriously, this lead story in the North Georgia News, this reporter did not translate all this. The jargon's important. Somebody got in a whole lot of trouble. The city, all those people, Mahan and Moore and those folks, they were in deep trouble. But you need to tell me that. And what is a writ of certiorari? That sounds bad. You know, that sounds really bad. And so you need to explain that. You do that for the reader because, no, there aren't many attorneys out there reading the newspaper. It should not take an attorney to kind of transcribe the newspaper or translate the newspaper. Give a human face to macro matters. Let the small represent the large. Example, in a story about the suffering that abortion causes women, give an anecdote, and you could lead with this, of a woman you have interviewed who bears profound physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual effects after having an abortion. I mean, you kind of view this like you might a sermon illustration, because this puts a human face on suffering that things like statistics might not necessarily do. It tells the readers why they should care. There's actually, okay, there were 35,000 women last year got an abortion. That's kind of cold and detached, but you know, here's Jane Smith, and look at the spiritual effects, the damage, the collateral damage that this abortion has done to her life. 15 years later, you know, it was on the verge of suicide. And I mean, that's how you put a human face on it. We're concerned about people, why this should matter, and not so much numbers. Although those can help prove your point, just a story that just has numbers isn't usually very helpful. And I think this is particularly important in doing journalism out of a Christian worldview. Tell readers why they should care, why this matters. Use logical transitions. Move readers from one chunk of information to the next with transitional words. And you don't try to improve on these, like conjunctions. You know, people, I've had reporters that try to be, well, I just said but and. Well, but's an adversative clause, and it's setting a contrast. People don't have to think about that. You know, I got up at 5 o'clock this morning, but I took a long afternoon nap in the afternoon. It's an adversative relationship. I mean, the Bible is very simple like that. I think the language, I mean, it's why in exegesis classes, you know that conjunctions and adversative clauses, they're all important. I mean, you use words like but and, nevertheless, therefore, still, meanwhile. We love therefore in Scripture, right? I mean, that gives us, it helps us walk through interpretation and application. You should write the same way. People want to get really fancy in writing news, usually young reporters. If they all realize, you know, it's a lot easier when I just use this, and the readers love it because that's what I like to read. So use logical transitions, lists and bullet points for difficult information. I had a list in my dissertation because you just couldn't write it. I mean, there's just no real place to put it, so I put it in a list. Great. I don't think I got critiqued on that at all. I've done that in theological papers. Do not bury good information in the middle of a sentence. Just as the Bible does, put key points of emphasis at the beginning or ending of a sentence. Your best stuff should be in the most emphatic locations. Include specific detail throughout your article. Specific. Don't be generalist. Be specific. Be general. Put off the general, just fuzzy terms and use specific, concrete language. We'll talk about that in a minute. Paraphrase in your own words quotes that contain factual information. I don't like to see, typically like to see quotes that will communicate something important, an important fact. I usually like the quote to communicate a response to the fact, or why this fact's important or not. I mean, it can be done, but I would not do that. The ending, the third part of the story. This should give closure to the reader and a sense that the writer knows what he is doing. You need to ask yourself what you want the reader to remember. And this is often last in memory. What does he want him to take away? Just strike that chord, that note again, and let that note just resonate and resound. There are several different types of endings, and here's just the five most popular types. The metaphorical ending. This works well when you want to evoke a response, either by making a biblical reference or placing the problem you've reported in some other cultural context. Kind of a contrast, an example from World, to a story on how the highly publicized tug-of-war of an adopted child ended. It's a good ending. No one is proposing that the child be cut in half physically, or speaking, alluding to Solomon. Most people are hoping that Jessica will not be sliced and diced emotionally. Good ending. It's good. That reiterates the main point of the story. Just kind of one more time. It leaves you thinking, yeah, boy, pray for this girl. The next step ending. Tell readers what happened after the time span emphasized in the article, like, you know, 2020 or 60-minute story. Here's the end of the story about a woman who did abortions in China but escaped having one herself. As for Qian and her family, they live in the southwestern United States. And now that Mahalway is in kindergarten, Qian is studying for her nursing credentials. She hopes one day to work in a maternity ward, helping to deliver babies, not destroy them. I like a next step ending. Kind of tell me, yeah, here's where they are today. You know, it's almost like today, in a good documentary today, they're doing this. Because I want to know. I don't want to be left wondering, what's happening to them today? Nail it shut. This is good. Use a quote that, a really, really strong quote that emphasizes in maybe a different way, a different shade on the story central theme. This is a personal favorite. Here's a story on Dr. Mueller's graduation address from a few years back on the dangers of the faithful gospel ministry, of a minister who will be faithful to the gospel and how that's dangerous. We want to live dangerous lives, he said. Some of you we won't see back here or even again on this earth. Some of you will be persecuted in the manner of your Lord. Some of you will go and die for the gospel, and God will be glorified in the spilling of your blood. That's a pearl, isn't it? That's right. I can still remember. That's how he ended his convocation address. And I think the first outside, you could just hear a pin drop. Because some of you will go and you will die. That was strong. And I remember saying, that's going to be the end of the quote, because that really strikes the chord in a different way. The implications. These graduates have been called to something that isn't easy. It's very difficult. You will suffer, and we may never see you again. I love the emotion of the moment, and it was just fantastic. A circular ending brings back for just a final look a central character of the article, and this increases reader identification. From World, in a story of the death of the logging industry due to environmental activists. Now, you might not be interested in this story, but it was very well written, just on the surface of it. But a full set of logging equipment for a site operation is called a site. So he's explaining what this means, not just using these terms, explaining what they mean. It includes a yarder, which is a diesel-powered drag line and tower, a shovel, and a cat. In 1988, Jim Gold owned three complete logging sites, employed 14 men, and had a net worth of $700,000. Okay, so what? Well, it's all gone. When you've lost everything, this is a quote, it's all gone. When you've lost everything, threats don't matter, he says. We've got no fight left. That's strong, isn't it? I mean, that is, you circle back to the front, but boy, this guy, he's lost everything, and it's all gone. And why did he give, unlike this North Georgia News article, I mean, he gave the some of the jargon, explained what it was and why it mattered. Wow, he's lost all this stuff. It was expensive. He's lost everything. And of course, there's the classic inverted pyramid. Puts the least important information or a quote that's not absolutely essential at the bottom so the editor can cut from the bottom. I was trained, this is my first part of my journalism school training. They had the first story you'll write, inverted pyramid. Those are assuming your story's not going to be that good anyway, so none of us like to assume that our prose is not Shakespearean, but, you know, a lot of it winds up on the cutting room floor, unfortunately, especially, you know, when you have spatial limitations. There's not as much of that on the internet anymore, but you used to have column inches in your story. I went out and covered a murder once, and my story had to be, I mean, it was, I had 8 or 9 sources, and I had to write that many words. That is about 9 column inches, and that's it. So it really makes you disciplined in your use of words. You buy them, you don't buy them cheap, or sell them cheap, or give words cheap. Any questions? I think, well, what are we due for lunch? We're about lunchtime. So I want to just look at these tips real quickly, but we'll do this. We'll do break now or blow through these quickly. Or okay, yeah. Let's do that. We got just some tips for effective news writing. We'll go through really quickly and then get into leads when we get back this afternoon, which I think is, I mean, it's the most important part of the story in the sense that you need to draw the reader in. You need to, you know, you've got to catch the fish. But it's no more important than the body once you've caught the fish to keep them swimming through your story. So, yes, sir.
I don't see myself in the journalistic world, but I enjoy writing. I enjoy the discipline of journaling.
Yeah.
And sometimes I can relate to what you said, staring at a cursor. You know, I cannot write. And so how would you encourage young men who have a desire for writing, and yet they look at their writing presently and they're not really encouraged themselves by it in terms of just the
I'm not... Yeah.
How do you get to the point where you just write whatever and take a bold, desired presenter?
That's a great question because I've been writing for 26 years and I'm not. There are days I just think this is bad. I should be better than this. You know, and I'll read Russ Moore or somebody and go, I don't want to write. Not to write anymore. I'm frustrated. I want to write like that, not like this. But I'm him and he's him. So, that is a great question. And my two things, twofold advice. Read good people, because you'll tend to write like the people you read. We'll talk about that more later, but read good people, read good stuff. And here at Southern, you're reading good stuff, but some of it's not well written. I mean, the Word Biblical Commentary series is good stuff, but man, don't write that way. That's true. Some of that's just mind-numbing. It's good because that's what it's supposed to be. The Puritans are wonderful, and I love I read the Puritans weekly, but boy, they could be wordy. So, I mean, they just say what they said, say it again. If you get miss it, say it again. Say it this way and that way, and they just kind of wear you out because that was, you know, they had more time on their hands, and that was the way they did things back then. But besides, I mean, read good people. I mean, I think John Piper is an excellent writer. You have an article on Christian eloquence I included in this package that I think is spot on in terms of what we ought to aim for. Is there a Christian eloquence, and are we to be eloquent, and how that jives with, you know, 1 Corinthians, not how the gospel is not carried by the eloquence of man. But read good people like that. Read men like George Will. I mean, there's a lot of good writers, even secular writers, very, very good. And there's some surprising places I'll show you this afternoon. I have to go back to my room and get it. There's some people have influenced me, and there's a couple of baseball writers who influenced me. A guy named Thomas Boswell, who wrote for the Washington Post. And, you know, lest you think that this guy is just some jock head who's, you know, cigar-chomping jock who writes about sports. This guy's an Ivy League-educated writer who's, I mean, he quotes Shakespeare and Plato and Dante and all, I mean, in writing about baseball and writing about baseball and history and American history. It's all woven together, and his writing is so compelling. And so I would read that. Growing up, I read that a lot because I thought, I want to write this way. Because this compels me in a way that, you know, the guy from the North Georgia News writing about the Union County Panthers just doesn't make me want to cut that out and save it, you know. But I had a file for a long time called Good Stuff. And Tom Boswell, a guy named Roger Kahn, were good. Read, I mean, you'll find it in strange places, good writing. So read good writing, one. And two, just write. I got told my friend who you know, get some clay on the wheel. I have to do that some days, and I'm writing for two blogs now. My church has a blog. I'm committed to that. I love to write, and there are days I hate to write. I'll sit there and I'll write something and say, that just stinks, but I'll leave it there because I know I can come and mold that. Because, and we'll get to this afternoon, you write and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. You never be happy with the first product, because the last product should be far better than the first product. If I have to dash something off and post it, it's usually not. I'll go back and find mistakes, and it isn't very good. And I'll say, I've written a lot of stuff that isn't very good, a lot of stuff, probably more stuff than I have that I seldom think it's really good. And go, yeah, that was just a great point, penetrating and compelling. But write. I mean, just write. Write. You're at a place where you're thinking. My dad tried to talk me into, I was infinitely wiser at 19 than I am now. And my father tried to talk me into majoring in philosophy or history or something else and be a journalist. Because he said the difference between you and them will be that you'll have something to say. Those people go to journalism school to learn how to write leads and learn how to write all those mechanics, all that stuff you're going to take. You can learn how to do that in the paper you're working for. Forget journalism school. Go and give yourself to philosophy or history or something else and then write about it. And you'll know, you'll have things to say. These people are not going to have anything to say. They're going to come out, they're going to be nitwits who are told what to say. You'll have something to say. And of course, my infinite wisdom, I major in journalism. But by God's mercy, and God has mercy on all of us, I mean, so merciful, brought me here at 30. And, the stuff I should have been reading, most of you guys are younger. You have a great opportunity. I mean, God has given you an opportunity to study these wonderful, wonderful, soul-satisfying truths. Write about them. I mean, just put the clay on the wheel and mold it. And be a good write. I want you guys to write. I want Southern Seminary to produce hundreds of good writers. I want us to be doing the talking because I'm so sold on the confessional vision of James Pettigrew Boyce and Albert Mohler. I'm so sold on this. I think you have something to say. Go say it. And you have a lot of guys. Kevin DeYoung's a good example of a guy who writes very well. He's a blogger. I mean, it's popularly written, but good stuff. I like what he thinks. I like the way he thinks. Russell Moore, Albert Mohler, of course, these guys here, their thinking is brilliant. But Dr. Moore's articles are not, they're not pedantic, are they? They're a joy to read. I love to read his, like I said, the honky-tonk jukebox or crossing the jukebox thing. I love it because it's always very witty, but he doesn't just give a Dolly Parton illustration to be funny. I go, oh, man, that's exactly right, you know, or Mama Tried. Boy, that's compelling. It isn't just, you know, something that's cute. There's none of that. There's no fluff in it. So read these guys. You're around good writers. I mean, Dr. Mohler, Russ Moore, there are lots of good writers here. I mean, Bruce Ware writes very well. Tom Schreiner is the most concise writer. He writes the way he preaches. And write, we're going to talk about this afternoon, write the way you are. Write your personality. Tom Schreiner writes his personality. Because in his sermons, he's very, you know, there's a short sentences, active verbs, stop, short sentence, active verbs, stop. And his writing reads that way. Now, it's delightful. It's very simple, but it's not simplistic by any means. So you have a lot of good models to read here. And I think in evangelicalism and even outside, there are lots of good models. And there's lots of models about how not to do it. Read some of my stories and show how not to do it. I can tell you all about how not to do it.